all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
Welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone. I'm the officer of the deck today. We've got some great programs for you. I think you'll find very interesting. We always want to remind you, you can find more about Veterans Radio at its Facebook site or by going to veteransradio.net, where we're on the web 24/7. You can find a lot of our podcasts there as well. We post new ones every Tuesday, so you can get a new story, a new interview, something you didn't know before by going to veteransradio.net. We want to thank our national sponsors, NVBDC.org. That's the National Veteran Business Development Council, the leading veteran-owned business certification organization developed by veterans for veterans. Find them at NVBDC.org or call 888-CERTIFIED. And also Legal Help for Veterans, a veterans disability law firm nationwide. You can call them at 800-693-4800 or find them on the web at legalhelpforveterans.com. I know everybody spent a whole lot of money on Amazon this holiday season. So our first interview is going to be with Amazon's military ambassador. I think you'll be surprised about what Amazon's doing to help veterans and military families. And our second interview will be with a principal at a school, but she wrote a book, Laura Naylor Colbert, a member of the Army National Guard, talking about her time in Baghdad, called How to Pee Standing Up. I think you'll find it an interesting conversation as well. So stay tuned. Pleased to have with us today Abby Malchow, who is a Navy veteran and is on the Amazon Global Military Affairs team. Abby, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you, Jim, for having me.
Well, it's great to have you on. Amazon is a corporate partner of NVBDC.org, and we want to talk about some of the things that Amazon is doing in the military and veteran space. Why don't you tell us what the Global Military Affairs team is working on?
Yes, good question. So our team is relatively new to Amazon, about 2 years old, and we focus on three core areas for the military community. The first is obviously hiring veterans and military spouses. The second is retaining them in their employment in Amazon and providing leadership opportunities for them and mentorship opportunities for them once they come to Amazon. And then third, it's kind of our catch-all. It's really our work in the community, both internal and external to Amazon. And it's within Project Honor, which is everything that falls under community engagement for our team, that I created the Military Entrepreneurship Program, which is how I started to work with NVBDC and became a corporate partner of them. And I can always explain to you later what Military Entrepreneurship Program is. And then also within community engagement, we focus on helping the wounded, ill, and injured, as well as helping to prevent suicide within the veteran community.
Well, one of the amazing things is that NVBDC has reached out to some of the biggest and best companies in America to help support veterans as they get into the business world, and folks like Amazon step up to be corporate partner. But they really do more. There are about 40,000 veterans working at Amazon, which is about 4% or more of the workforce, if I've got it right. The veterans have become a big part of Amazon, hasn't it?
Yes, that's, I think it was, I forget the year, but I think it was the Joining Forces Pledge where Jeff Bezos, don't quote me on the year, where he vowed to hire over 25,000 military veterans and spouses. And obviously we have surpassed that goal. And what we've seen at Amazon is that veterans, the military community in general, they are such a good fit for the culture at Amazon because of the leadership principles that you learn in the military very much translate into the work that we do at Amazon. And and they typically excel once they come to the company. So, you know, we're obviously always looking to hire more and more veterans because they just have that work ethic and that discipline that is required to succeed.
Well, one of the things I guess I wanted your viewpoint on is, as you were going about your setting up of the military affairs team and under Project Honor, why did you think it was important to become involved with an organization like NVBDC and focus on certified veteran-owned businesses?
Yeah, that's such a good question. So when I created the Military Entrepreneurship Program, and we all love acronyms in the military, so I just call it MEP for short, we wanted to really use that as a way to help entrepreneurs and also to help underemployment and unemployment within the military community. So we see entrepreneurship, small business ownership, as really a form of employment because you obviously are creating your own business, you have to sustain that business, and we want to help provide them the tools and the resources that to scale through Amazon, right? So when I created the program, I really wanted to focus on bringing more certified veteran-owned small businesses and service-disabled veteran-owned small businesses to sell on Amazon Business. And then I also partner within Amazon Consumer and help veterans and military spouses launch as sellers there so they can sell directly to consumers and ultimately scale their business. So that was the intention behind the program. And obviously with NVBDC, they have such a large membership and they're very well known in the military community. And they are one of the nonprofits that certify. And, you know, they're an organization that Amazon has always believed in.
Well, it is important, and we've spoken before in the spotlight on why you want certified veteran-owned businesses to get away from some of the shenanigans that was going on in the early years, and it's really important to know that you have, a legitimate veteran-owned business here. And this is both, you mentioned it, both on the business side and the commercial side. Can you explain those two sides a little bit again?
Yeah, so Amazon Business, which is very helpful to clarify to the audience. Amazon Business is where certified businesses sell to other businesses. So, you know, obviously you have to have that certification in order to be recognized as a veteran-owned small business or a service-disabled veteran-owned small business. And it's really like shopping on Amazon, but it's businesses shopping on Amazon from other small businesses and other large businesses as well. And consumers where you basically sell directly to the consumer. So, for example, we launched a veteran-owned small business as a seller, a third-party seller the other day, and he makes a toothpaste, and he's very much an entrepreneur. He just created this toothpaste, and we launched him as a seller there, and he's going to be selling directly to people like me, right? So those are the two primary differences. And once you sell on Amazon Business, you automatically, all of your products, usually all of your products are also available on Amazon Consumer as well. So, you know, if it's relevant to the consumer audience, you'll still be able to sell through both channels.
Well, I think sometimes we've heard the phrase B2B, and that's the Amazon business-to-business selling platform, I take it.
Yes, it's B2B, and then consumer is, we call it consumer, but it used to be known as Amazon Marketplace, is B2C.
Well, I wanted you to talk a little bit about also what Amazon Project Honor is about and how it has some focus in mental health and suicide prevention, because I know in your background, your work background and advocacy background, this is something of particular importance.
Yes. Project Honor was formed earlier this year. And, you know, the work that Amazon has done, our team has done really, in veteran suicide prevention really came to us organically. So, you know, I have a, you know, very personal connection to suicide. I found my squad leader dead from suicide just after we got back from Iraq. And then a month later, I lost my best friend to suicide. And I tried to intervene to save his life, but failed. And he ended up killing himself just a month later. So for me, it's very personal. And, you know, it was why I worked, help advocate for the Clay Hunt Suicide Prevention for America's Veterans Act back in 2014. That legislation was then passed into law in 2015. And from there, I was a scholar with the George Bush Institute through his Stand Two Veteran Leadership Program. And when I was a scholar with his, in his program, I really focused on how can we find technological solutions? How can we leverage artificial intelligence to identify veterans at risk for suicide on social media platforms and then intervene? Because what I saw through my own experiences were the first warning signs of suicide are usually on social media. And some, you know, when they find people at risk on social media, they don't necessarily identify them as a veteran. And we all know that veterans, they have unique conditions such as traumatic brain injury, PTSD, military sexual trauma, and they really need to be connected to someone who can help provide that specialized care. So that's how I got into my role at Amazon. And we did a very similar project that finished earlier this year with Rallypoint. And for those who don't know, Rallypoint is a social networking site for veterans and active duty military and their families. So it's very similar to Facebook, but specifically to the military community. And Rallypoint had a project in partnership with the VA and Harvard where they were going to also use artificial intelligence to identify users on Rallypoint at risk for suicide. So they approached me and we saw obviously tremendous value in helping them achieve that. And so we worked with the AWS machine learning team to develop an algorithm through machine learning. And the project on our end is complete. It's obviously going to continue to be developed on Rallypoint's end. And we have yet to see the impact of what the project will have. But, you know, that was really how we started getting involved in suicide prevention. And from there, it has just continued to grow. And we obviously see a lot of need within the military community, especially during COVID, where, you know, so many people could be at a higher risk. And we really want to leverage Amazon technology in order to help these nonprofits who are working to help save veterans from suicide.
Well, I think that's a great explanation and really one of the powerful things about American corporations like Amazon is their desire to help others. There's no immediate return on investment here, but this is important work that Amazon and you are doing, A.B. Malchow, and I'd like to turn, though, to how did a nice person like you end up in the Navy for 19 years?
Yeah, I guess I'm a glutton for punishment, aren't I? The two fun facts, I joined the Navy right before 9/11, and I picked the Navy. My whole family was Army. I picked the Navy because I was like, oh, if I ever go to war, I'll be on a ship. Well, that backfired because I've never been on a ship and, you know, I've only been to war, right? So I spent most of my Navy career supporting expeditionary, which for those who don't know, expeditionary is, you know, Seabees, Coastal Riverine Group, Special Warfare. I was in Special Warfare. I'm not that cool. But I spent most of my career on the ground, not at sea. So that's how I ended up in Iraq. You know, and then I separated to finish my education because we all know it's impossible to really finish your college education when you're constantly getting deployed and it's just very difficult. So I then transferred into the reserves and from there, I'm now at 19 years and, you know, I don't regret, you know, the decision at all. So.
Well, you not only finished your education, you picked up a master's in business administration from the University of Maryland after picking up your bachelor's degree, cum laude, which means honors, at the University of San Diego. So many folks find along the way that the military and the GI Bills helped them get that education that's kind of helped them transition. But your time in Iraq was, as many folks over there have seen, you know, was peppered with RPG attacks and suicide bombers and daily fire in Ramadi. All of that had an impact on you and ultimately an impact on your transition into civilian life, didn't it?
Yes, and you know, I'm glad you brought that up too, because you know, in 2006, when I went to Iraq, no one even really talked about PTSD. It wasn't even a term then. And you know, I survived multiple traumas during my military service, some directly related to Iraq deployment, most were not. So I really ignored my symptoms for years, and it wasn't until my third car accident in 2018 that I was forced to get help for PTSD, and that's when I was diagnosed. So my transition was brutal. I know a lot of us, when we come back, we have recurring nightmares. I have terrible insomnia. When I went to college, when I transitioned out and I went to college, and University of San Diego is a private college, I just did not fit in there. And I didn't feel like I could relate to anyone. And it took a lot of professors who saw that in me, who saw that I was really struggling, to have those heartfelt conversations with me and say, hey, it's okay to be different. You know, it's okay. We get it. And, you know, it really, my transition has never stopped. I think to veterans, we often think transition, oh, it's one and done. I'm going to find a job. I'm going to finish college. That will be my transition. I think we never stop transitioning. And that's something that we really need to have these open, candid conversations on. It's almost impossible to find a dream job the minute you get out of the military. And, you know, you're never going to stop evolving what you're looking for in your career and finding your purpose. So it's okay to be forgiving to yourself and to understand that, hey, it might take me some time. My transition, if you want to call it that, because I still don't think it's ever finished. You know, by the time I got to Amazon, that was, let's see, we're talking 8 years after I got out of active duty. So it took me 8 years to finish college and to find myself at a company like Amazon, where I felt like I finally fit in, you know? So I think we need to be more forgiving to ourselves when we talk about transition.
Well, I think that's great advice. And I'm sure as a chief petty officer, you've probably passed it along to your guys over time. It's hard to be forgiving because, we're all designed, particularly in the military, to be hard chargers and just suck it up. And as you avoided the effects of PTSD until you couldn't, can you talk a little bit about you know, how you got some help, some counseling, some therapy, where you went, and maybe give some guidance to others who, hey, this might be something for them to try?
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of data that says that I think over 47% of post 9/11 veterans at risk for depression and PTSD. They never seek help for their symptoms, and we all know the culture in the military is to tough it out. And you know, you often think that people will see you as being weak if you go get help. And I believed that for many years, especially as a woman. I didn't want anyone to think that as a woman getting help for my mental health, that I was weaker than my peers. So for that, I avoided it. No, I had terrible anxiety and every time I got into a car. And, you know, I was rear-ended. My third car, I've been rear-ended a lot. It's a miracle I'm alive. My third car accident, I was rear-ended at over 70 miles an hour. It's a miracle that I even live. And every time I got into the car to commute to work, because my work was about a good half hour from where I lived, I just had incredible panic. And my chest would tighten up. I couldn't breathe. I couldn't sleep at night. I kept seeing the image of that, of the truck hitting me. And my healthcare provider, I begged him, I'm like, please give me some pills so I can sleep. And he said, no, I think you really need to get help. I think it's more than just insomnia. And he referred me to a psychologist, and I was very skeptical. really very skeptical. But then when I found out that she had worked for over 10 years in the VA and she was very used to help to treating veterans, that made me a lot more comfortable to opening up to her. And, you know, I have remained in and out of care ever since. So I think it's important to say there are strengths in seeking help. And you never know when you're going to be at risk. You never know when something could trigger you and you could have that flashback and be extremely vulnerable. And no one is excluded from being at risk for suicide. No one, right? So it's important to really see the strengths in getting help.
Well, and you saw the other side of it. You told us earlier about suicide from your squad leader. I mean, the other side of that is if you don't get some help and do some things, you may spiral down and out. And one of the things I noticed in a write-up that I have, AB, is that you kind of used physical activity to help cope at some level. Can you talk about that?
Yes. You know, I think in the military, we very much rely on being physically active as a way to decrease the stress in our lives. And, you know, for me, I've always been a very active person, but I had a lot of running injuries during chief season. I had a torn hamstring. No, it was a torn calf. I tore my calf twice. And then I've also suffered from torn hamstrings. So I realized that I just couldn't run like I used to anymore. So I picked up cycling, both road cycling and mountain biking. And I took a birthday trip one year. I spoiled myself and I took a 2-week trip where I did some mountain biking the whole 2 weeks and through France and Italy. And I was hooked after that. And, you know, with my work with the Bush Institute, he has the Warrior Care. Let me just say he has Team 43. That's what everyone knows it to be is Team 43. And Team 43 is a program that President Bush created for post 9/11 wounded warriors. And he has two sports. One is golf. The other is mountain biking. So I was selected to do the mountain biking and I got to cycle on President Bush's ranch, which was a once in a lifetime opportunity. And, you know, when we were there cycling, he's very much an easy person to talk to. I shared my story that I just shared with you about finally seeking help. And it was wonderful because we had an opportunity as wounded warriors to connect with each other and to find that supportive network. And that is so valuable. I think veterans really struggle once they get out of the military because they no longer have that network that they had, that community, that camaraderie. And it's important once you get out to find it again and to always stay connected to it in some capacity. And whether it's through physical activity like Team RWB, or you could do it as a mentor. You know, there's Travis Mannion Foundation, Team Rubicon. There's so many ways that you can really find that community. And that's what was so rewarding about that program.
Well, you mentioned networking, and this has been one of my peeves or soapboxes, is that in the military, we've got our network, but it's not the business network. And you get out and you have to build that business network. You had it in the military, but now it's a different type of network you have to build, and you need to take every opportunity that exists to build that network. And that's really what you're kind of doing at Amazon with Project Honor and Military Entrepreneurship Programs, is helping build that network for veterans in the business community, aren't you?
Yes, and it's good that you bring that up because I see a lot of veterans struggling with that as well, because a lot of folks know that you really get hired through your network. You really find new opportunities through your network, not so much in submitting an application. And I think our team has done a really good job at bringing recruiters across Amazon together who specifically are looking to hire military veterans and spouses, and creating that network that virtual network because of COVID for the military population and giving them the opportunity to meet with different recruiters across the company and see, well, maybe I fit in here, maybe I don't fit in, and being able to ask those questions directly to them. That is so, so important. And I can't stress enough when I do a lot of mentoring through American Corporate Partners as well. When I talk to veterans transitioning, I can't stress that enough. Find a mentor, you know, continue to grow your network, connect with fellow service members, connect with fellow alum. There's a lot of ways you can reach out to people and have those conversations. And within the military community, we're never going to not help another vet. That's just not our ethos, right? We are so committed to each other, and we have unique experiences, unique shared experiences, and we're always going to be able to lend a helping hand. At least I like to think so.
Oh, I think that's absolutely true. Having been on Veterans Radio for years, veterans who I speak to often say, well, just have them call me. You know, they give out their cell phone number, or here's my email address. And we're talking to Abby Malchow, who is with Amazon Global Military Affairs Team, which is a corporate partner of one of our sponsors, NVBDC, a third-party certifying company. And Abby is a chief petty officer in the U.S. Navy. He's got 19 years in. Abby, we really appreciate you taking some time today to talk to Veterans Radio. And if somebody wants to know more about Amazon, and maybe if they fit in for a job, or maybe they want to sell B2B or B2C to the consumers, can you point them to a couple of maybe website addresses that they should check out and get more information?
Yeah, I always refer everyone to amazon.com/military. It's pretty easy to also Google the work that our team is doing, but amazon.com/military will help get you to the right place you need to be. And if you're interested in selling on Amazon or starting a business with Amazon, you can always go to amazon.com/build-your-business. And, you know, I always encourage folks too that to you always can connect with me on LinkedIn. I'm never not going to help a vet. So, you know, just want to put that out there too.
Well, we appreciate the time and the words of wisdom that you've given to our listeners today, Abby.
Thank you so much, Jim, for having me.
I hope you enjoyed listening to that interview and hearing that Navy veterans' personal story, as well as the corporate story about what Amazon's doing for veterans and military families. We're going to have another interview with a woman veteran who also served in Iraq that I think you'll find just as interesting. So listen in to that interview. But before we get there, we want to thank, among others, our local VSO sponsors. This includes the Vietnam Veterans of America Charles S. Kettles Chapter 310, VFW Graft O'Hara Post 423, and American Legion Post 46 in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And we welcome sponsorship from VSO posts from all around the nation, so you can reach us at veteransradio.net to help us out on a sponsorship from your organization. And now on to our discussion with Laura Colbert. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today Laura Colbert, an Army National Guard veteran. Laura, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we're really happy to have you on and to talk about some of your experiences in the Army National Guard and some of your overseas duty assignments and kind of what coming home was like. But I should tell our audience first that you are currently a principal at a middle school in Wisconsin, and we were just joking about the challenges in today's environment with in-person classes and hybrid classes and A and B classes. you've got a challenging job, don't you?
That's exactly right. There's never a dull moment.
Well, we'll come back to that later, but let's start with your family has a military history a little bit, and your dad was a Vietnam War military police officer, and your sister's an Army infantry medic. So
my brother, my brother.
Oh, it's your brother who's the medic?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
So
tell us a little bit about that background and what led you to join the Army National Guard.
That's a great question. I was a freshman in college, and I had run out of my scholarships and couldn't find another avenue for financing my college career because my parents had originally said they were going to be able to help, but I have a twin brother as well, and I think with the two of us in college at the same time, it was more than they had anticipated. And so in February, on a very cold, snowy day, I decided, why not join the National Guard? So I didn't know anything about the military. I decided that I would do it because I wanted to serve my country. I love adventures. I was always looking for something new to do. And obviously, I needed college paid for. So, and I thought it would be great to go on peacekeeping missions and the like.
Let's set the timing on this because that's part of what's going on while you're a freshman at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Yeah, so I was at UW-Madison, and it was March of 01. I signed on the dotted line to join the military. And then 6 months later, almost to the day September 11th happened. So we went from a very peaceful time to one of the unknowns, and it really threw me for a loop. But again, I was always up for adventure. So until we actually got into war and got even a few months into it, I didn't realize, you know, what it was all going to hold for us.
So let's, I mentioned earlier that you were with the military police. Did you mm-hmm. go into that because you thought you'd want a career in law enforcement or how did you end up there with?
That's a great question. When I signed up, I was given two choices. One was to be an MP and one was to be a mechanic. And the military police one definitely sounded more interesting. And that's what my dad was. And it was the closest a woman could get to the front lines. So I jumped on that opportunity.
Well, one of the things that you say about yourself in the book, and the book is How to Pee Standing Up or Sirens, an Alarming Memoir of Combat and Coming Back Home. And we'll talk about all of that. But one of the things you talk about is sort of with your civilian hat on, you see yourself as a pacifist. So explain to me how you reconciled not only joining up, but being military police and getting close to the front line with that view of life.
Mm-hmm. It's a great question. I really felt like I had to compartmentalize my time at war versus my civilian life. It's, I don't know if you've heard of the term moral injury, but it is exact identification of what that world is like, in that I grew up my whole life learning great conflict resolution skills, having civility in my own home, practicing communication at its utmost, and then going to war where you have an issue with somebody and the guns come out. And so it was a very different world for me. And really, truly, I don't ever feel like I'm one and the same. In fact, when I got home from war, I have yet to shoot a weapon. I don't want to have anything to do with weapons. You know, cringe at the thought of killing or anything of that nature, obviously. Hopefully all civilians feel that way. But it's definitely two different worlds and hard to navigate. And potentially that's why I had the post-traumatic stress upon my return.
Yeah, I think a lot of folks understand what moral injury is about. And I think a lot of people understand that, you know, regular good folks put into the situation of combat, it's going to impact them. Going to impact them probably for life. And and you joined thinking, well, this is just going to be peacekeeping missions. But in six months or a year or so, a couple of years, I suppose. You know, you sort of spun up, got trained up, and found yourself with orders. Tell us about what happened in that junior year of college.
Yeah, you know, I'm going to rewind a little bit to a basic training in AIT. So I did what's known as split option, where I did a few months of basic the summer between my freshman and sophomore year, and then I went back for AIT, which is advanced individual training for my military police training, the summer between my sophomore and junior year. And while you're there, they do a lot of work on your psyche to create this unknown enemy. So you really do have a thirst for hurting somebody or injuring somebody or getting that person who wronged you. And that's really what led me into the ability to fight in within the war or feel this innate sense of wanting to retaliate. When you march, you do songs about killing people. And when you're practicing bayonets, you're stabbing a dummy and say, die, 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 or kill, kill, kill. And so it's this brainwashing, essentially, that gets you in that mindset to carry out acts that, again, you would never think humanly possible as a civilian. And so I had that mentality going in. First of all, I wanted to win the hearts and minds. I wanted to get to know the culture. I wanted to help the Iraqi people. Ultimately, that servant within me wanted to do the best thing I could possibly do. However, when we started getting attacked and mortared and IEDs along the roadside and shot at and you name it happening to us, really that sense of wanting to retaliate came in full force. And I had an intense amount of hatred within me for the Iraqis in general. And what's really interesting is I think, let's say, 07 or 08 or something, I gave a presentation in my hometown where I now live in Waupaca. And a school psych saw that presentation. And she has since seen a presentation, almost identical presentation that I gave within the last year. And she said that the amount of anger I had back in the first one I gave has diminished substantially compared to the anger I feel now. So she could even sense that a few years after I got home, how angry I was about the deployment, which has now, like I said, diminished. Thank goodness.
And you went in, I think it was 2001, but I had a note and I can't find it now. You got discharged in 2009. So you spent eight years in service. And how long were you deployed overseas?
We were deployed for about 16 months. So March of 03, and then we were done in August of 04. We were home for a month and was put on leave for a while to follow up or finish up our deployment. We officially got home, I believe, on the 28th of July, 24th of July, something like that. But I did my 6+2. So when you're in the National Guard, you sign up for 6 years of active drilling and then 2 years of inactive ready reserve.
And tell us what your assignment, I guess, you were doing during those, year plus in Baghdad.
Right. So we spent a month and a half in McCoy, Fort McCoy, Wisconsin, figuring out what they were going to do with us because we were there even before Baghdad was bombed. So we didn't even know if there was going to be a war when we first started our orders. And then we spent another month and a half in Kuwait, again, waiting to find out where they were going to put us. The Marines had brushed through the whole country, taken it over. And then once our Humvees arrived, we drove straight up to Baghdad, and that's where we were placed for the duration of our deployment. And our first job there was to work in the Iraqi police stations to train the Iraqi police officers on how to be proper police officers, some of whom had been police officers under Saddam's regime and some of whom had just started as a police officer because they would get a consistent paycheck of $100 a week, a literal $100 bill they would get in their hand once a week. And then from the Iraqi police station, we did escort duties. So we escorted UN ambassadors, senators, diplomats, and then we escorted our brigade and did gate guard and went back to the Iraqi police station on the southern edge of Baghdad towards the end of our deployment. So we were getting ready to go home and then had gotten extended and were supposed to help then with up to 6 or 8 police stations anywhere from just south of Baghdad to 2 hours south.
And when you come back, as you say, you're sort of your still had a whole lot of anger that had developed, hadn't you? How do you think that deployment impacted you as a woman country, and then when you came back home?
I was so hardened and unfamiliar with how to maintain myself in civilian world. I walked down State Street, which is a pedestrian street in Madison, and I was spitting, and my friend looked at me and said, "What are you doing?" I'm like, "Oh, I didn't even realize I was doing that." And I went into my parents' house and was talking to my mom, and I said the F word 3 times in one sentence. And my mom just gave me one of those inquisitive looks like, "Are you okay? Like, is this the way you are going to be from now on?" And driving was crazy. Because I drove everywhere in Baghdad. My primary job was to drive the Humvee everywhere we went. And so when I got home, I would run red lights. I would yield at them, but then go through because that's what we did in Baghdad. I would drive down the wrong side of the street to go around traffic. I remember one time I almost had a head-on collision because I was trying to avoid a bag of garbage on the side of the road and put myself back in that Humvee, and the civilian car on the other side was headed right for me, and it was a split second decision to go back in my lane. So lots of things followed me thereafter. And I don't know, I mean, as a woman, I think probably that was intimidating to other men. I certainly, just as a college student, didn't feel like I belonged, which is the whole reason why I started giving my Iraq presentations, was simply to close that civilian soldier gap and feel like we could have some sort of commonality among us. And then writing this book, the whole purpose behind that as well is to share some of those more intricate details that people don't think about. Like, how did a woman pee in an urban environment? And what did you do to stop your period or to take care of that? Or, you know, how did you even manage these different things that people don't think about, right? So anyways, yeah, it's different, but I'm sure it's very similar to a lot of men who come home as well.
Oh, undoubtedly. And I think it's helpful for not only other veterans, but family and friends of veterans to sort of understand a little bit of maybe there are some unique different situations women found themselves in country. Mm. For example, in that culture, men can't talk to Iraqi women. Talk to us how you interfaced in that situation.
Well, I've read about how women soldiers have to follow the religious rules, say in Saudi Arabia. But when we were in Iraq, it wasn't as strict. And especially since Saddam Hussein was gone, there wasn't really that religious rule like there is in Saudi Arabia. So we surprised a lot of the men and the women when they saw us and realized we were women. They couldn't believe it. I had to search a lot of the women before they came in the police station, and many of them thought I was a man, and they would swat my hand away and tell me to go away, and I would have to take my Kevlar off and show them my hair, and then they would have this realization look on their face. There was one point where I had to show a guy, Iraqi police officer, how to clean the police station because it was a disaster zone, and my job apparently was to make sure it stayed clean, but I didn't have to do it. I just had to tell this Iraqi police officer what to do, and he did not want to listen to me at all until another police officer cuffed him on the back of the head and yelled at him in Arabic, and then he started listening to me. We called him Mr. Clean, which probably wasn't that appropriate, but that's what we called him, and he then listened to what I had to say thereafter. So
sometimes it takes a slap on the back of the head.
I guess so.
And we don't recommend you do that in your job as a principal at the middle school.
No,
but nowadays you can't do that. But
no.
So it's about 11 years later since you've gotten out, you wrote the book How to Pee Standing Up as sort of a therapeutic tool for yourself. Can you talk about that?
Sure, yeah. When I was in Iraq, I journaled every day. And so what I did was I took that journal and put it into a Word document in 07 and finally found Julia Dye out of Warrior Publishing Group, thank goodness. And she assisted me in really turning this thing into fruition. And mind you, I ate a lot of humble pie with her because I'm not the best writer, but I feel like it turned out okay.
Well, we all need help with those issues. But one of the things that you were, I think, trying to communicate, and I'd like you to talk a little bit about, is not only your own experience with PTS and mental health issues upon coming back, but sort of how you work out of those problems. How do you find the help? How do you move forward?
Yeah. So as you had mentioned, this definitely was a therapeutic tool for me. The more I talk about my experience in Iraq, give presentations, talking to you right now, writing this book, those are all processing opportunities that help me put those memories into a certain bank and create more positive connotations towards those. I also really reached out to my fellow female veterans for assistance. Just knowing I wasn't alone, creating that solidarity helped with my mental wellness. And the other part is just sharing my experience with others and creating, shedding that light on what it's like is also very beneficial. Again, closing that civilian and soldier gap helps so much. It just really helps create that more of a solidarity feel again, that we're more of a community in this, not just you versus me. And I had one more thing I wanted to say, but it's gone now. So ask your next question and maybe it'll come to me.
So I think one of the things that people struggle with is kind of getting started and then sticking with the path that's going to get them into a better place. This doesn't happen overnight. Talk to us about, when you look back now and reflect, how long did this take?
Oh, it's never going to end, really. I can tell you that I've gotten a lot better, but it's never going to fully go away. And with me, I suffered a lot of different triggers that would bring on intrusive thoughts and post-traumatic stress episodes. For example, the full moon, because in the month of August, I was working night shifts at the El Shab police station, and I would see the entire lunar cycle and think, okay, my parents are seeing the same moon. My friends and family are seeing the same moon. I'm not on a foreign planet. Like we have this thing in common. And then one night in 07, I saw the full moon and had a post-traumatic stress breakdown, or I was building a fence with my husband and the nail gun caused me to have a post-traumatic stress breakdown. And you just never really know when it's going to happen. But I think, I started having, it was called delayed onset because it didn't happen for a year after I got home, but I started having panic attacks and breakdowns in August of 05 and finally saw somebody at the end of September, beginning of October. And it took me about 5 months of counseling and therapy and anti-anxiety medication until I was able to stop taking the medication and really slow down the therapy to the point now where I don't have therapy. I don't take medication, but I know what I need to do to get out of my funk, essentially based on the help that I received.
Yeah, I think that's important for folks to hear. It's not going to be overnight. It may take months, and for some it may take years, and that's okay.
Yeah.
It is whatever it needs to be to get in that better place.
I was going to say, you need to find that avenue for you that helps you. Is it yoga? Is it therapy? Is it going for a walk in the woods? Is it talking over a beer with your buddies? You know, what is going to help you? And then utilize that to the utmost.
I wanted to come back and ask you, I said at the outset, you'd sort of viewed yourself going in as a pacifist and coming out kind of an angry woman for a while. having worked through this progression, give us your comments on how you think the media portrays what everybody's doing over there from the lens that you have, which is somewhat unique.
Well, I think that's another reason why I wrote the book, because I don't feel like the media has done justice to the sacrifices that the soldiers have made overseas. And I wanted to show our country and the world what soldiers are still going through. Afghanistan is a war that's still officially going on, and you don't hear about it anymore.
Right.
So that's really the bottom line. And when there was a draft, when World War II and Vietnam and World War I were happening, the entire country was in it, and they were helping with it, and they were involved, only they were against it in the case of Vietnam, but they were still involved with it and knew about it. But the lack of media around Iraq and Afghanistan really drove, or was one of the driving forces behind the writing of this book, too, and the fact that I give presentations.
One of the things I would like your view on here is, you know, you went into the military to get some college education funds, and your dad had experience in the military, your brother ultimately had experience in the military. Mm-hmm. As you think about your children and they get to the point where they need to get some funds for college or otherwise feel a call to serve, how does Laura Colbert, Army National Guard veteran, combat veteran, Iraqi veteran, think about that day when it comes?
Oh, such a good question. As I'm watching my three children play on the slide out the window, I would feel like, I hope I would support them. And I would joke, I'm going to joke with you and say, hopefully they join the Air Force.
Right, exactly.
I would have a long conversation and weigh out the pros and the cons. I have been nothing but open with them about my experience in Iraq, and hopefully knowing, having some of that background, that will help their judgment as well. But ultimately, they need to do what's going to make them happy. And kind of as my dad said, there was no talking me out of it, and he just had to learn how to support my decision. And so hopefully I can do that with my own children. And would it break my heart and would I worry every second that they're gone if they get deployed? Absolutely. But
that's the natural mother thing, right? That's no different than every other mother who has to send their child, whether it's male, female, you know, Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, that, you know, everybody's going to worry. That's just the natural part of it.
Yeah.
But
I talk to them about their other service options, Peace Corps, Coast Guard, Air Force, you know, and just lay everything out and find out what would fit their personality the best after I get to know my kids as adults, you know?
Well, you are in a unique role as principal of a middle school to shape young minds, and they are lucky to have somebody with your life experiences, because I'm sure on a daily basis, some of the things you learned in the military, you're still applying.
That's exactly right.
And I don't mean the basic training drill sergeant.
No, but as an MP, I now know how to search, you know, rooms, and I can do investigatory work on the students and resiliency and grit and all that fun stuff. Yes.
And some of that grit in particular is a particularly valuable trait for youngsters to learn. Sometimes they think it all comes easy, and they might look at you and say, well, everything's always been easy for the principal. Well, I want to thank you for spending some time with Veterans Radio today and giving your perspective on service and some of your views on what we've done right or maybe what we've done wrong, and in particular, the advice you've given to folks who may be dealing, whether it's friends, family, or themselves, with sort of military mental health issues or moral injury.
Yes. Yeah, thank you for having me. And as my parting thought, if we're getting ready to wrap up here, is I have had multiple people thank me for writing this because they now better understand their family members or their friends after their friends and family members have returned from war, based on what I've been able to put into words here and how they can better support those family members and friends. So that's also been a very validating
outcome of this book.
Laura Colbert, why don't you tell everybody where they can, the title of the book and where they can get it?
Sure. So you can find it on Amazon, and it's Sirens, How to Pee Standing Up, an alarming memoir of combat and coming back home. And some really exciting news is we are going to release the audio version on Cyber Monday, which is the, you're going to have to forgive me here, I believe it's the 30th of November.
I think you're right.
So the audio version will be ready to go before Christmas.
Well, again, thank you, Laura, for spending time today with Veterans Radio.
And thank you for having me.
I think it's kind of easy to forget that a lot of our veterans these days are women, and that they have had experiences that certainly have resulted in, you know, them evaluating moral injury, maybe PTS, maybe a TBI, but things that are going to have an impact on their life. And we owe them, just like we owe their male counterparts, continued support, recognition. The VA's got to do what needs to be done. The federal government has to provide them the medical health care that they need to get through those experiences that they picked up as a result of their service. So I hope you found those interviews enlightening, maybe something that you didn't understand that women veterans were experiencing. So thanks for listening to Veterans Radio. As always, you can find us at veteransradio.net or check us out on Facebook. Give us any story ideas by contacting us in that fashion. And we'll be back next week with more interesting stories about the veteran world, the military world, and we'll bring you our best ideas. And until next time, this is Jim Fossone, and you are dismissed.